Welcome back to episode 10 of the Verde Podcast. Every week we talk to local business leaders and entrepreneurs to understand the real story that doesn't make it to the spotlight, but is how actual businesses are actually built here in Chicago. Today we have Tim Frick, who is the owner and CEO of Mighty Bites, and I've been able to follow Tim for a couple years. He's quite a leader in the Ravenswood community as well as the social enterprise community in Chicago, so welcome, Tim.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So, Tim, tell me a little bit about Mighty Bites specifically. We'll dig a little bit into the B Corp and Corp thing, but tell me about Mighty Bites. What year you started it? What drove you to build your own business?
Sure, yeah. We started 20 years ago this month, actually.
Wow.
It was a different internet back then and different digital agencies, and it was completely different. In fact, we've seen several significant shifts over the 20 years that we've been in business and the kinds of business that we do, the kind of things clients are looking for and such. I started the business to do meaningful work for meaningful organizations, and since the beginning, we've focused a lot on education, and, you know, social enterprise wasn't really a word back then, but we did do a lot of work for nonprofits, and so that has kind of grown and evolved over the years as well, and once we became a B Corp in 2011, we went kind of like all in on that stuff, and that's been a whole interesting evolution of the company.
Who were your early clients? Who were your first couple clients, and what kind of projects did you work on for them?
Sure. Our first project was actually an interactive game for a toy company called Learning Curve Toys. It was an educational game, similar to that game Perfection, where you push the plunger down and you have to put in all of the pieces in a certain amount of time. It was kind of like a virtual version of that. And we did a lot of motion graphics and kind of interactive media. Back then it was like Flash and Director some DVD-ROM authoring and such. But that kind of evolved over the years to content management systems and telling better stories online, and then we got more complex with software development, and we've done a number of exhibits for museums around the Chicagoland area. That sums up. And now I'd say we're doing a lot of work in four different service areas. We do a lot of strategy and consulting, so helping our customers kind of align their digital marketing channels. We do a lot of design and UX, and a lot of web and software development, as well as digital marketing and optimization. So they kind of the work that we do falls in those four categories, and oftentimes our customers kind of go through that life cycle from one to the next to the next.
That's nice for recurring revenue.
Yeah. And it helps. And I think having that kind of larger, kind of omni-channel, bigger picture approach to things really helps our clients figure out how to make sense of all of the things that they're doing in the digital realm.
Well, I'm sure spending time figuring out the strategy first actually helps the process in the second and third buckets like go smoother and much faster and more better for you as the contractor as well.
Absolutely. Although we do make sure that we focus not too much on like trying to flesh everything out up front.
Yeah.
Like many agencies, we evolved years ago from waterfall to kind of more agile based practices. So we do a lot of iterations. We'll come up with a bunch of hypotheses on what we think will work up front, and then we'll prove or disprove those hypotheses over time using these various kind of disciplines.
I do. Before my company evolved to what it is, we had an iPad app and an API that showed energy savings, and I didn't know it at the time, but I'm definitely an agile person. I would never work well in waterfall, mostly because I'm just not organized enough to be.
I can relate. Absolutely. Yeah, it's so much more of a better way to work. And in fact, we've kind of taken what originally was more of a software development, and then slowly evolved to a project management process. Now we kind of apply that process to everything and consider ourselves, we really focus on organizational agility internally, so that we're okay with making mistakes as long as we're learning from them and course correcting as we go along.
It's funny, I can hear someone else like talking about their business, and I can quickly think, well, if you apply agile principles, like, this would be so easy to solve. But then in my own company, I never do it. So
right,
I should.
Right.
And I talk about it and I think about it, but when it comes to application, sometimes it's smart. It's helpful to have someone from the outside looking in.
Oh, for sure. That level of objectivity is definitely necessary when you're trying to do this kind of stuff using agile methods.
And so I assume it was just you. Who started the company?
It was just me. Yep. Okay. I was a freelancer working out of my back bedroom, got really busy, and I was lucky enough to have some really cool clients right up for it from the get-go, and over time built the company based on that. So I went to art school. I got a bachelor's in writing and film studies and a master's in film studies from Columbia here in town. So Mighty Bites has been my business education. I really made lots of mistakes over the years, but have learned from all of them and didn't have a clue at the beginning, especially about how to kind of run a business. You know?
Yeah, likewise.
I think it's a business. Running a business is a lifelong learning opportunity for pretty much anyone who does it.
Yeah, I went to grad school and studied environmental policy, and I, in some ways, am envious of people who have MBAs because they study how to run a business. But I've never met someone who said that it truly prepared them for running
a
business.
Right, exactly. I figured it out on day one.
Yeah. And give me just for people that don't know Mighty Bites, kind of an idea of what you guys are like today. How many employees?
We're 7 people, plus a handful of contractors and freelancers that we work with based on our workflow expanding and receding. You know, that's pretty common in the digital agency world. We do a lot of small projects as well as a lot of large projects. We have a bunch of long-term ongoing retainer clients.
Cool. How many customers in general, like in last 2017?
You know, that's a good question. We just closed out the year's work. I can tell you the numbers. I'm not sure exactly how many customers that we worked with. Definitely 2 dozen at least, over the time. But some of them, like I said, small little things that we just help them with. We do hosting and website maintenance for our clients, so a lot of them have just small contracts with us. Some of them we do SEO work over time. So we have a lot of kind of ongoing recurring revenue. And then we have a couple, like I said, larger clients.
Do you have like a rule of thumb where you try to spread out the work, where you make sure one customer doesn't become too large of a problem?
Absolutely. Yeah. I made that mistake early on. We were working with a large tech company, one of the Bell companies in the late 90s when we first opened, and they were a majority of our work, and then they were like, oh, well, we're not going to work with you anymore. And, that was a really tough lesson to learn. And so I've really tried to diversify our client base in as much as I can without like losing our soul or staking, we want to stay focused on a specific kind of work if possible. So I try to keep it diverse, and I also try to diversify the income stream. So we do project work, but we also do, like monthly retainer work and stuff like that. And that definitely helps with the peaks and valleys of cash flow.
Which come with any business.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure.
So you talked about the client focus and like who you go after. Tell me a little bit about the Benefit Corporation and the B Corp, which you are both. Describe that for people that don't know that,
sure,
as well as how it applies to your business.
Totally, yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, we have been working with like mission-aligned and mission-driven organizations since the beginning. Education has played a huge part of that. A lot of the stuff that we do has an educational component to it. We have always been, sustainability focused. I've always been an avid environmentalist. And so when we were up in Andersonville, we're down in Ravenswood now, but when we were up in Andersonville, we were members of the Chamber of Commerce there. They had an eco certification that we went through, and we got like a 3 out of 4 stars for our certification. And that was kind of like the gateway drug for me to becoming a B Corp, because it kind of opened my eyes about, it's not just about, recycling or changing out light bulbs, that there's a much larger thing there. And so I learned about B Corp certification on a climate ride in 2010, I was fascinated by it. And we had been, at the time, apps were like all the rage and stuff, and we had been doing some internal brainstorming on what that might look like for us, and we realized all of the ideas that our team were coming up with had some sort of mission focus, some sort of good cause, kind of, were driven by altruism and education and stuff. So, we were thinking, well, how do we actually make that a little bit, how do we, walk the walk and actually draw a line in the sand to say this is what we stand for? And so we're a for-profit company. We want to be for-profit. The more profit we make, the more we're able to align that profit with better purpose and offer better benefits to our employees and, all that kind of all that kind of stuff, be a better community player, corporate citizen, etc. So, you know, the L3C, which you mentioned your company is, I looked at it. It's certainly, that was the first thing that we looked at. We were intrigued by the idea of being able to get grants and stuff like that, which as a corporation you can't get. And then the B Corp certification came along, and when I learned more about it, I was like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
So we went through the certification process, which can be, you know, pretty challenging and arduous for the first time in 2011. We've just finished our fourth recertification in the fourth quarter of last year. Scored highest ever. We finally cracked the 100-point mark, which is no easy feat.
Yeah.
And then in January of 2013, the state of Illinois passed benefit corporation legislation. So the B Corp is a certification similar to, like, you know, Good Housekeeping has a certification, or Fair Trade has a certification. You go through a process. It's an audit of your processes, and you know, you fill that out and you get a score based on how you perform, and then you use that as a benchmarking tool to improve over the years. The benefit corporation legislation allows you to change the legal structure so that you actually can make sure that you align purpose and profit alongside each other in the way that your business runs legally. So as a benefit corporation, we are legally required to provide some sort of societal benefit alongside, you know, the standard corporate, you know, edict of earning and generating profit. So we change that up every year. We kind of evolve those processes and what that means to us as a company. And then we produce a report every year that says this is the benefit that we provided to a society alongside, you know, pursuing profit.
How many benefit corporations are there in Illinois?
That's a good question. Last I checked, which I think was last year, there were over 50.
Okay.
That's a little bit harder to track. You can go to bcorporation.net and actually track how many certified B Corps there are. They have a search engine, and you can actually see. And there's about 2,500 or so B Corps right now around the world, over 50% of which are in other countries. But benefit corporations, you'd have to go to the individual states who passed the legislation and look at the Secretary of State's office, you know, listing.
Yeah, I started the company in 2010, and I was very excited about the L3C concept, how it kind of ties in a mission to your revenue. And still to this day, every dollar of revenue my company generates goes towards reducing energy. So the L3C concept kind of petered off in its ability to kind of, like, excite the marketplace. I think the IRS never really ruled in a way that really made it recognized. And so it's good to see that the same kind of theory of, like, mission focused, but still for profit, because I totally agree with you. Like, I love nonprofits. I like, you know, hearing what they do, but there are some things that I think for-profits can do better.
Right. And there's opportunities in both sectors for us to learn from each other. I love being in this kind of hybrid fourth sector where we can learn a lot about how to run with more of a conscience from nonprofits, but nonprofits can also learn a lot from for-profit companies about how to run as a better business.
Yeah.
And so it's a really great opportunity to share a lot of knowledge.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite parts about running Mighty Bites? What do you wake up in the morning, you know, first thing that you're thinking about and ready to go?
Sure. It's always a balancing act. It's a really competitive industry. So, you know, there are over, like, 560,000 agencies around the world that do some variation of what we do, whether that some of them could be just specifically on blogging or copywriting or content. Some could be specifically focused on web development. But that's a lot of companies who do what we do around the country. And you know, having been around a long time, you know, we have amassed a lot of experience. So it's tough to compete, you know. Business development is always a challenge, but I also really love the variety of it, and you know, the fact that we have taken much of our 20 years and focused it on finding really good clients, and I'm very proud of our portfolio. And so being able to do ongoing work that, you know, really literally changes the world, I'm very proud of that, and that's really exciting. We're one of the few agencies that apply sustainability principles to the process of creating digital products and services. So when we became a B Corp, you know, each company gets to define what that means for them. And we were like, well, as an environmentalist, you know, we'd like to be able to figure out how we can be a better, more environmentally friendly company. And right around the same time, I was, you know, learning about the environmental impact of the internet, which is massive. I mean, it's more than the airline industry. And at the time I was learning about it, it was about a billion tons annually of CO2. CO2 emissions. And so I was, you know, kind of floored by this because I was like, well, wait, that's what I create every day for a living. And yeah. So how can I, you know, how can I reduce our impact? And so we went on a long mission to find really good green hosting. We were trying to find a lot, either other B Corps or a lot of smaller companies to support. We ended up landing on Google Cloud Platform because of the companies that are around. They are like super green focused and really impressive. And it's also a very scalable and expandable solution for our clients. And then we started kind of doing standard kind of life cycle assessment, you know, efficiency processes on our own process, figuring out like how can we make sure that what we built is optimized, efficient, and powered by renewable energy. And so we've been working on that since about 2012. We created a free tool called EcoGrader, which is at ecograder.com, and people can put their URL in and they can crawl whether or not and find out whether or not their site is kind of sustainably focused.
Cool. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it uses the green hosting web hosting database and kind of cross references whether or not you have green hosting, and then identifies a bunch of things in the areas of UX and content and findability for performance optimization for efficiency and such. So we created that. We created a microsite called sustainablewebdesign.org. I wrote a book called Designing for Sustainability. So it's really been kind of part, it's become part of the philosophy that guides, you know, Mighty Byte's mission.
Do you find that draws in a lot of customers, that focus?
You know, I think not as much. I think people appreciate that we do that. I think there's a lot of people in business who are still like, oh, it's green. How much extra does it cost? Right. You know, I mean, like we get a little bit of a side eye every now and again, but people love when when our clients really appreciate the green hosting thing, but they also really love the efficiency thing. They also are like, oh, you mean my site's going to run faster? Yeah. It's going to be friendlier for users. It's good that people are going to be able to find things faster. That's awesome. I'm all about that. So it's not... We don't typically lead with, like, you have a green website. We more lead with, like, you have a really optimized, efficient website that is going to be better for your users and better for your company's bottom line and thus more sustainable for the long haul.
Yeah. 5-6 years ago, when I've switched a bunch of URLs over the years, and I custom built our website and hosted it at Small Orange because they had...
Yep. Yeah, we work with them.
And to this day, everything is still hosted there, even though I don't know that they're very good at what they do, but the green focus got me, so...
What we struggled with a lot of the smaller green hosting providers, especially since we do some, you know, we do work with some larger organizations like YMCA and Allstate and a few other, you know, larger companies, it's hard to go with the smaller provider. A lot of them, the commitment to renewable energy is certainly admirable. There's not necessarily a hand-in-hand, you know, approach to customer service and reliability, and so we would have websites go down a lot. We would have to be waiting with some of them, some of the green hosts we work with. We'd be waiting for significant periods of time to try to get answers as to why certain things were happening with our website. And you know, our clients would be like, absolutely not.
Right.
No way.
Right.
So
the one thing you have to do is keep that site.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was ultimately why we ended up going with Google Cloud Platform. As much as I love supporting small businesses and especially other B Corps, we just wanted to make sure that we were covered in terms of reliability and customer service. And so
they're 100% covered by renewables.
The company went 100% in 2017.
That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, for a company that size, it's pretty. Yeah. I'll take it for sure.
What do you, and just to stay focused on that, do you have any thoughts about Bitcoin mining and the environmental impact of that?
Yeah. I've heard a bunch of different things that, you know, a single Bitcoin transaction uses as much energy as your house in a week, and every time new Bitcoins are released, they use as much energy as the country of Iceland, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of things out there that are
Those can't be factual.
A couple of them are from, you know, factual resources like Guardian and Fast Company and stuff like that. We haven't really cracked that nut in terms of how it impacts our own work yet. Blockchain in general offers a lot of opportunity for sustainability because of its transparency. But I do think if indeed it is using as much energy as people are purporting that it is, something's got to be addressed there.
Yeah.
Like before it explodes, or before it gets as much larger.
Right.
You know?
Well, and I'm sure that creating a penny with copper or whatever isn't exactly environmentally safe either.
Right, so, for sure.
I'm sure it takes careful analysis, but definitely the buzz right now is that it's it's a polluting currency, which is
right, which is crazy. Yeah, yeah. And that's that. I think overall, the biggest eye opener for me in the last 8 to 10 years has been that we've been brainwashed in the digital age to think that digital is better, digital is more sustainable, digital is greener. You know, it replaces paper. Why wouldn't it be? All this kind of stuff. And so much of the research is showing that in certain cases, it's actually not better. Yeah. You know, and so we've really put as much effort as we can as a small company into trying to figure out like how to be as sustainable as possible in all of our practices, right down to like, you know, buying pens for our design labs, like markers for our design lab that have like soy based, you know, replaceable ink cartridges and stuff like that. So we've kind of, you know, put that philosophy across the business.
Yeah. Well, it's good to hear. It's good to hear, and it's reflective from everyone I know who talks about you. They've always shared that anecdotally that you're pretty
those environmental nerds.
Well, you're not a, it's not greenwashing, right? You don't just talk about it; you do it, you live it.
I think and it can be tough and a struggle, and it can be a lot of extra work depending on what it is that you're trying to do. And but it, to me, you know, if we have a better, more sustainable future for our planet, I'm all about that.
So. What is the most, so you said 20 years.
Yep.
So in 20 years, do you have a particular time that was the most challenging running Mighty Bites?
There have been a number of them right after 9/11. I had 10 contractors I was working with and basically had to tell them I had no work. You know, about February of 2002, I basically went down to myself again and went back to freelancing. We had some real struggles with the Illinois budget crisis in 2016 because it just, you know, so many of what we do, a lot of local work, and so many of our clients were reliant on that money. And the first thing that goes when a nonprofit isn't getting the money it's used to is marketing projects. And so we had a real struggle with that, and we had to do some kind of significant pivots in how we do things. Yeah. We don't typically reply to RFPs anymore. And you know, there's a number of things that we did over the course of the last couple of years to bring ourselves, you know, to do a pivot, but also, you know, keep our soul. Like, we ended up this 2017, we were like 18 times more profitable than we were in 2015.
That's awesome.
And even though 2015 was our highest grossing revenue ever, 2017 was, you know, short of that by like one project. And yet we were much more profitable. So that's definitely some changes that we made for the better.
So I totally agree with you on the RFP process. Like, whenever I'm bidding against somebody else, I feel like I'm just a cog, right? Someone wants to replace the lighting, they're going to do it anyways. I'm just there to facilitate it. I much prefer to be an organization. And I'm kind of like you. I'm more drawn to business development and sales as the owner of a company. I like to go out and educate someone who they weren't thinking about this, but here's why, and here's why this will
Take
itself in a couple of years. So I totally agree. RFPs just are you're always a year late to that.
On so many levels, it's a race to the bottom. You know, I mean, if the person issuing them is making a choice solely based on price, someone like my company is never going to be able to compete on price because they're 20 years old. We have a ton of experience. We're not the cheapest thing on the market. We're not the most expensive either because we're a small company. But, you know, we don't want to compete on price. We don't want to do the cheapest job out there. And then, you know, there's also kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, an RFP necessitates that you do all this specking up front and that you do all of this work up front that ultimately you end up throwing away when you start doing continuous learning and agile practices, and you learn as the project goes along and you're like, oh, well, that didn't work. And so it's just like this huge waste of time. And on top of that, money too. There's a guy out of Canada who said that Canada alone estimates that they waste $5 billion a year on responding to RFPs. Like, companies spend that amount of time responding to RFPs, and so they waste $5 billion of their gross national product every year just responding to RFPs. That's a lot.
Yeah. And do you, and I see the point why some organizations need to have multiple bids and to get a good idea. But personally, I don't. When I, you know, we hired a marketing firm last year, it's called Tacklebox, to do kind of a brand manifesto for us. And once I met them and it made sense to us, like, I didn't need to shop.
We
got to a price that worked, and we scaled back the project to where it fit for us. But I don't even know. I mean, I see the point of RFPs.
For sure.
But I couldn't imagine doing it.
I think the biggest challenge there, at least to what I've seen, is with nonprofits, because so many, they do RFPs because they're grant-driven, and the grant is a finite amount of money, which kind of necessitates a project fee and a kind of, you know, and what happens is that puts this knee-jerk reaction on behalf of the nonprofit to cram as much as they can possibly cram into that project for the amount of money that they have without possibly testing it first without,
right.
And so they'll throw a bunch of features at something, and then you launch and it's like, oh, well, guess what? Half of those things don't work, or the users actually don't want that. They want this other thing. And so I think, yet the, you know, agency is may try to, you know, coerce them or help them to kind of better understand a better way of doing things. But if you're contractually obligated by what you responded to in an RFP, which was all the way up front, you know, you're it's you know, it can be potentially lose-lose, you know.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
So the last question I always ask people is about we've talked already a lot about this, but making sustainability a priority within your business. So we've already talked a little bit about that. So I'm curious, you come from Michigan, right?
The UP.
So what was it that growing up in the UP that drove that into you as a priority?
Proximity to nature. I mean, honestly, that is it through and through. I grew up in the woods. I grew up on a lake in a tiny town in Upper Michigan. And having, as much as I didn't appreciate it growing up, like once I turned 18 and was ready to go off to college, I was like, see ya, I'm out of here. And wanted to be around, you know, urban culture and be in cities and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it didn't take too long for me to realize, oh, you know, I appreciate cities that have proximity or access to nature. And, you know, Chicago's got a really amazing lakefront, obviously, and a really amazing set of forest preserves and stuff. But, you know, to be in big nature, you have to drive for a while. You have to get way out to be in a, you know, place where you're, you know, in, you know, a lot of nature. And I really appreciate that. And I just, you know, have always had a kind of conservationist mindset about that kind of stuff. And as I became more and more educated on the role businesses played in environmental issues over the years, I just became more and more passionate about that, and more passionate about making sure that I'm not part of the problem, that I'm part of the solution. And that was one of the things that, like, seeing the B Corp certification and having this benchmarking tool for building a better business, I was like, the light bulb was on. I was like, that's the thing that makes sense, and that's what's going to fix us, you know?
It's nice. I would say I don't find it common, but it's nice when you're running a business and occasionally you catch that moment of, like, clarity and connection with something else.
Totally, yeah, absolutely.
So, Tim, we've never really gotten a chance to talk much. I've known you for a long time, superficially and through other people, but I was impressed and glad to have connected.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you very much for the chat and the talk. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Tim.